Hello, I'm Jessie Roski. I'm one of the internal medicine hospitalists at St. Cloud, and I'm the medical director for the section of improvement at CentraCare. And I am privileged to be joined today by Dr. Jack Lyons, one of my colleagues in intensivist medicine at St. Cloud Hospital. We are going to be chatting today about sepsis a little bit, and I thought I'd start by reflecting on our different training paths, Jack. And I know you and I worked together alongside each other for a few years now, since just before the pandemic, I think you started. And I don't know that we've had like a quiet moment to just sit down and get to know each other a little bit. But I was at the University of Minnesota for my internal medicine residency. So I got to do my ICU time at the U of M, which is kind of an intense ICU space. And I got the chance to do that as my elective my senior year. I really always liked ICU medicine. I remember in my training, so I've been practicing for over 10 years now, so I feel like dating myself with the old training. But I it was a huge thing of like, what are the inclusion and exclusion criteria for activated protein C when I was training? And then, you know, I think there's always been this elusive effort in sepsis to find some magic bullet that will change our maladaptive dysregulation, you know, steroids, a magic vitamin cocktail, you know, none of it's really panned out. And I'm wondering if you can reflect upon your training and what you, the focus of sepsis when you were in training.
Yeah. So my name is Jack Lyons, and I'm a critical care doc at St. Cloud Hospital. Like Dr. Roski said, I started in September of 2019. So this is 3 years on the nose for Nicole and I. For those of you who met my wife, Nicole, she's a trauma surgeon here. We started in September of 2019. We both came out of Hennepin County Medical Center. So I did internal medicine residency at Hennepin, and then did a chief resident year, and then did a two-year critical care fellowship. And in that fellowship, you spend the majority of the time at HCMC, but you also rotate in that very intense ICU at the University of Minnesota that you described, as well as Abbott Northwestern and Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. So good, well-rounded fellowship time. You talked about activated protein C or a drug called Zygris, which had gone out of favor by the time I was doing my training, and was actually held up as almost a ghost story. Right? Don't get fooled. Don't get
right.
We're always, there's this holy grail. We're always chasing this magic thing that's going to make it all better. And as it turns out, Zygris wasn't that, and probably vitamin C isn't that, and steroids aren't that. And so those in my training were always held up as, gosh, all the really smart, good folks chase this for a little while and always be vigilant about what's coming down the path and what's getting hyped at the moment. I think that's a good jumping off point to talk about. I think we've got four tasks today, and I think the first one is to work on identifying sepsis. And so as I understand it, and Dr. Roski, you can correct me if I'm wrong, sepsis was invented in 1991?
I think so. Yep. We didn't have the idea of SIRS, at least, before 1991.
There were no infections before then.
Right. But, you know, I think that's a good jumping off point. I agree. I'm not sure we'll tackle all four tests today, but we'll try. But I think that most of the controversy is around how does one identify sepsis. And
right.
With the elusive holy grail, it means that we have to get back to basics, right? It's a heterogeneous condition. It's difficult to identify, which is what we'll focus on today. And there is no magic bullet to fix it. It's try to correct the underlying source if you can. It's try to support the patient in their hemodynamics as they hopefully can recover. And it's doing all the other important parts of critical care medicine. And I think the identification idea then is, to your point, in 1991, that's the first time we had the idea of SIRS with the first consensus definition. And since then, we've had consensus definition 2 and 3. And that's where the controversy comes. And I love the term controversy. I remember in med school being like, is it like reality television? You know, it's like the idea that something's controversial in medicine is a fascinating idea. But if anything is controversial, it's sepsis 2 versus sepsis 3. And I don't like the framing of it versus. I don't think it's one or the other. But I think that's maybe the problem, right? Sepsis 3 kind of said you have to throw out sepsis 2 and start over. And take us back to 1991, Jack. What, you know, what's the idea of SIRS? Let's just start there for people who are back at the basics.
Yeah. So everybody's heard of SIRS or has some nebulous internal definite. It has a strict definition. So Tmax below 96.8 or greater than 101. Tachypnea or respiratory rate greater than 20. Pulse greater than 90. In our mind, we think of tachycardia as 100, but to meet SIRS criteria, pulse greater than 90. White blood cell count less than 4,000, greater than 12,000. And notably, in the initial sepsis 1, the SIRS criteria, there's no mention of hypotension. And so in our mind, we think, well, he's in shock, he's hypotensive, he must have sepsis. That wasn't part of the original definition. And so these are, as you can imagine, these are nonspecific entities. You can certainly get there with a whole host of problems that aren't necessarily infectious in nature. And so if it's nonspecific, a good test anyway is at least very sensitive. And so sepsis 1 catches a huge chunk of folks who may ultimately go on to be proven to have an infection causing their critical illness, but it doesn't necessarily help us differentiate between an infectious cause or some other cause of this systemic inflammation.
Right, and the absence of hypotension is because by that point, things are severely dysregulated and the patient is seriously ill. And the idea then of SIRS is the early recognition of the entity of sepsis before somebody has hemodynamic compromise, right? And the emphasis on that once your patient is hypotensive, you should be very concerned.
Right, yep. And so sepsis 1 SIRS criteria is a great start. Catches everybody we should start to be worried about. The hair should stand up on the back of your neck, or pick your metaphor. If I meet SIRS criteria, I got to do a deep dive here. And these are the folks that we can't afford to miss on.
And it's usually a marker of badness, even if it's not infectious, is the way I look at it. Like, you should take another look at the patient anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. So then, you know, the benefit of it is it's very, very sensitive. But as you said, it's not very specific. So then in 2001, we get sepsis 2, so the next consensus definition. And of course, it sticks with the idea of SIRS. It did acknowledge that it's not specific. There's this quote from Sepsis 2 that I really like, which is that ultimately, this scheme seeks to codify the physical and laboratory findings that prompt an experienced clinician to conclude that an infected patient, quote, looks septic. You know, and you'll get that call and sign out from the ER. The patient looks septic or they don't look septic, you know, but then like, what does that mean? And our levels of exposure to seriously ill septic patients can vary, and our clinical skill in the entity can vary. And there isn't a black and white up-down test that can say this patient is septic and isn't septic. That has also been an elusive holy grail, you know, that we don't have a biomarker that can tell us for sure that's what this is. They talked about that in sepsis 2, and it's been 20 years and we still don't have one. So instead, it's our clinical acumen, right? But, you know, SOFA, I think some people think SOFA was invented in sepsis 2, or in sepsis 3, excuse me, but it shows up in sepsis 2, in fact. What's SOFA?
So the sequential organ failure assessment score is generally, it's a way to try to put some quantitative data to this idea, does this person look sick? And so we've got lots of different ways to get at, does this person look sick? Sepsis 2 adds all sorts of specifics to this definition of SIRS. Edema, altered mental status, hyperglycemia in the absence of diabetes, keeps the low blood pressure, or I should say it adds low blood pressure, which is new. We'd always associated hypotension with sepsis, but now it adds it formally. It adds a mixed venous blood gas, cardiac index, other signs of end organ dysfunction. And so you've got a PO2 to FiO2 of less than 300, kidney injury as defined by a creatinine jump greater than 0.05, which is different than the KDIGO guidelines, but just put that number out there. Elevated INR suggesting poor hepatic synthesis, low platelets, elevated bilirubin, oliguria. So sepsis 2 adds all kinds of markers of end organ dysfunction, which is great, right? It helps give folks a guidepost and starts to let us measure some of those things more quantitatively, looking for end organ damage. And so sepsis one is great. It's very sensitive, catches everybody. Sepsis two now starts to add some specifics with the goal of hopefully putting some numbers or specific symptoms to this broader idea of systemic inflammation.
And I think it's interesting that there's a really nice table in the actual publication of sepsis 2, where it kind of identifies all those markers you might want to pay attention to. But one that's interesting is the tissue perfusion variable of a lactate above 1. Mm-hmm. And that's like, wait a minute, hold your horses. Like, that's not necessarily abnormal. I think the idea of hyperlactatemia being an emphasis and kind of another one of those nonspecific markers of badness that you might want to pay attention to. There's a lot of controversy of like what level of lactic acid should get your attention. I would argue just above 1 is maybe a little too conservative, then you're going to be finding all sorts of just normal lactates. Depends a little bit on the lab. In St. Cloud, we define elevated lactate of above 1.8. Mm-hmm. But I think we've had some really great data come out since then from the Surviving Sepsis campaign, decades of data now, looking at how robust lactate is as a marker of badness. And, some people, payers in particular, I guess I would say, try to write off the idea that a lactate between 2 and 4 is not clinically significant. And I'm wondering if you can put that in context for us, meaning it's nonspecific. But what do you think about when you have that patient with a lactic acid of 2.5 or 3?
In my mind, it's a sensitive marker. It's, again, nonspecific, but it's an indication to me of some tissue hypoperfusion or perhaps some poor hepatic clearance of the lactate that's being made, which, again, suggests significant injury. If you've got poor hepatic clearance, you've got some liver injury, which itself is a bad problem and a big ends up impacting your mortality rate tremendously. And so, again, in my mind, even a modestly elevated lactate is another reason to dig in, make sure you're not missing something, get extra tests, reassess the patient later, check in on the urine output, swing back to the bedside. And even a modestly elevated lactate is potentially a canary in the coal mine that things are getting worse for the patient or that there's some metabolic dysregulation happening within the patient.
Yeah, and I referenced the Surviving Sepsis campaign data on lactate. So just briefly, when it's between 2 and 4, if it's associated with hypotension, it clearly has an odds ratio of mortality associated with it as well. So it's definitely a marker of badness when the patient is hypotensive. And then it's like that canary in a coal mine, just taking that second look of the patient. But also, very interestingly, when the lactic acid is above 4, even in the absence of hypotension, there's a significant odds ratio association with mortality. And right. So that's interesting because right around the time that the sepsis 2 consensus definition is really kind of set and we've all become comfortable with it, and Surviving Sepsis has asked us to pay attention to it, and we've beaten the idea of SIRS into everybody in training and every nurse that ever works the floor, then we get the SEP 1 core measures in 2015, which basically copy that. So CMS is saying now we get a quality measure, and we've had years to get comfortable with the idea of sepsis 2, and now we need to follow it. And the SEP 1 core measures kind of modify this idea that you can identify or diagnose the patient with septic shock by having a lactic acid of 4 or above, which is, that's an interesting idea, even if they don't have hypotension. Because that, when I first read that, I was like, where did they go to training? I never heard such a thing. But then when you dig into the Surviving Sepsis guidelines, I think the evidence is fairly robust that should definitely make the hair of your back of your neck stand up. Unless, of course, maybe you can explain the lactate away with something else, like they're chronically alcoholic and they're intoxicated, or they're on metformin, or they have, chronic liver failure, and you can say there's, a patient, but you need to look, right? You need to look and see, do I have an explanation for this? But it should definitely raise your hackles a little bit. Okay, so then 2016 hits. We've only had SEP 1 core measures for a year. It's a very difficult core measure. It's a when we have to hit every single element in order to pass the core measure. So everyone's hair is on fire over how they can make sure to comply with this core measure and try to get our quality standards to demonstrate the quality care we're giving. But then the rug is pulled out from under us 1 year later when sepsis 3 is published in 2016. So the numbers get confusing, but now we're talking about another consensus definition of sepsis 3. And this one upends everything. Right. So what's the controversy behind sepsis 3?
So sepsis 3 removes the SIRS, which they felt was too nonspecific. And this is where you'd mentioned SOFA came out in sepsis 2, but this is where we start to lean on SOFA. So the sequential organ failure assessment score. And the idea we're trying to be very specific. Now we're gonna hone in on what's happening, what's driving here. The trouble with sepsis 3 is that it misses a ton of sepsis. And specifically, it misses it because it is too specific. It excludes folks that are probably, in hindsight, are on the cusp of sepsis. It's, well, I think he's getting septic. I wonder, you know, it's that sign out. You get a good experienced bedside nurse. He or she calls you to say, "Why, something doesn't smell right here. I'm worried. I don't, a couple of blood pressures are okay. A couple aren't so good." Sepsis 3 misses those. And a huge percentage of those folks go on, one, to be diagnosed with sepsis, and two, to have a significant risk for mortality. And so as everybody's comfortable with sepsis 2, we're settled in, we're using it to meet our core measures. All of a sudden we say, no, that's not it. And we're going to rely on SOFA. And as it turns out, sepsis 3 probably misses the folks we care most about. The folks where, gosh, if we can catch this early before they get hypotensive, before they get shocky, before they need to transfer to the ICU, sepsis 3 unfortunately misses a huge chunk of those folks. And so that's where the controversy lies. Sepsis 2 catches way more patients. Might be a little overkill sometimes. Maybe it's a little unwieldy at times, but it catches just about everybody that's going to get sick. Sepsis 3, in response to that, in response to saying, "Oh gosh, it's too big, it's too unwieldy," sepsis 3 pairs it down to SOFA, and then even further sometimes to QSOFA, and we end up missing a chunk of folks who could really benefit from early therapy.
Right. I mean, there's been a huge amount of controversy in the 6 years since it was published, and there's some really nice editorials calling out and articulating exactly what you just described. There's one quote I really like, which is the idea that sepsis 3 definition structure does not clearly identify patients in the early stages of sepsis, where rapid resuscitation provides the greatest patient benefit and improves survival. A change to the existing definition could disrupt the 15-year trend toward further reduction in sepsis mortality. And I think, you know, the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg put it well when she said, it's like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. It's like we were doing well understanding and recognizing early with that emphasis on a very sensitive screening test, and now we're kind of throwing that out. I think people couch it as SIRS versus SOFA. And I don't think it is that. I mean, SOFA is very good, but it's a better prognostic tool than it is a screening tool. And they put forward the QSOFA as a screening tool. You know, the other problem with SOFA is it's unwieldy. It's difficult to memorize. You got to pull up the MD calc and everything to remember all the numbers. It's not like SIRS where you can quick remember it and look at it in your head. So they put forward QSOFA, and then that just turned out to not pan out at all. So much so that the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines in 2021 recommended against QSOFA as a screening tool. So I think the issue here, the way I reconcile this in my practice, is SIRS is a better screening tool. SOFA is a very good prognostic tool, and you have to use both, and you have to put your thinking hat on and really try to determine back to the, does the patient look septic?
I agree totally. And to piggyback on what you just said, the 2021 Surviving Sepsis Campaign recommends against QSOFA, like you said, as does the Infectious Disease Society of America, the American College of Emergency Physicians, American College of Chest Physicians. None of those endorse sepsis 3 as the be all end all, or as a full transition from sepsis 2 to sepsis 3. And so I very much like your idea of using both.
Yeah, I think, you know, so CentraCare trying to provide our clinicians some guidance, you know, we got together and kind of put together our own definition of how we want to function. And our best guidance is that it's a good idea to use both, but we fully support the idea of sepsis too. I think going back to the idea of controversy, it's like people will feel there's so much data to keep up with and there's so much information to keep up with. And maybe you're practicing in clinic and the ER and inpatient, and how do you keep up? And, you know, so our goal is to do what we can to just provide people some guidance with the idea that sepsis 3 is very controversial. It is okay to not feel like it's a settled conclusion and throw SIRS out. And we really, I think there's valid points in both methods of evaluating the septic patient. So, well, at this point, you know, I think we had a really great conversation. I want to thank you, Jack, for your time. We really did just cover that idea of how does one identify sepsis, but that is, I think, the most controversial area and also the most important area, because unless you can have that high index of suspicion, you will miss the patient or they will be seriously critically ill before you recognize the decompensation coming. And I'll just remind people that sepsis mortality is higher. The in-hospital sepsis mortality is higher than STEMI or stroke, and we need to treat it as the medical emergency that it is. And furthermore, the sepsis mortality for the patient who develops sepsis in the midst of their hospitalization. Now, so you're not thinking broadly and putting an ER evaluation and then an admission evaluation on the patient, and everybody's paying a lot of close attention, but they decompensate and develop sepsis somewhere in the middle of their stay, their mortality is extremely higher. So our ability to have that early recognition, to have our clinical skills there, to have a high index of suspicion and reassess that patient when those markers of badness make the hair on our back of our neck stand up is, I think, one of our most important duties here. And always give that nurse the psychological safety when they call and say, this patient doesn't look right. You know, you want to always think critically about what they're telling you and why you may or may not need to be worried. So any closing thoughts for us today, Jack?
Well, I want to highlight what you just finished with. Never, never, never ignore a bedside nurse calling to say something's not right. Of the sins that we make in the hospital, I think that's potentially the biggest. So those are the folks that are at the bedside day in, day out, for hours and hours at a time. And so when those folks say something's going the wrong way, that has to be a call for us in training. And as you're training students, as you're training residents coming through, that has to be a call. Nope, we got to go to the bedside. We have to see what's happening.
Right. And it's easy to get overwhelmed. You know, you have, you're cross-covering a huge number of people, or somebody else is critically ill down the hall, or you're in the midst of an admission. But we must never be short with those people and always be willing to consider their evaluation. We have a lot of new nurses at St. Cloud Hospital right now, but I think that's, we want to have them end up with the psychological safety as they get comfortable in their career here, to know that the physicians support their thinking and welcome their questioning and welcome their ideas when they're concerned. So,
absolutely.
All right, with that, we will close today. And I want to thank Dr. Lyons again for his time. We do have a couple other topics on sepsis we may cover in future, and hopefully you found this useful content.